Yesterday, October 10th, the radio industry was shocked and deeply saddened at the announcement by Cumulus Media's Westwood One that one of its longest-running, most successful, and universally beloved syndicated talk show hosts would be hanging up his headphones on Friday, October 14th, due to health issues. It was a surprise to many, but industry insiders were already aware that this broadcasting legend was suffering from an advanced case of esophageal cancer, and the prognosis was increasingly grim. His career that spanned more than five decades, including the past 30, as host of his own solid late-night syndicated show, is one of the greatest of all time. His achievements include induction into the NAB Broadcasting Hall of Fame, the Radio Hall of Fame, and the Missouri Broadcasting Association Hall of Fame. He received the First Amendment Award from the Radio Television Digital News Association and the Lifetime Achievement Award from Talkers Magazine, along with more honors too numerous to begin listing here. It's with profound sadness and love that I have the honor of presenting this interview to the public. Our guest this week is Jim Bohannon. Welcome to the Michael Harrison Interview, the weekly podcast from Podcast One for media freaks, pop culture aficionados, political junkies, and the philosophically curious. Thank you for downloading this program from Podcast One, Apple Podcasts, the Podcast One app, and Spotify, and for following our Tuesday tweets announcing the names of our weekly guests. To sign up, it's at MH Interview. I can be reached directly via email at michael@talkers.com. If you find this show to be of interest and value, please subscribe to it as well as giving it a positive five-star review on Apple Podcasts. Okay, here we go. An uninterrupted conversation with Jim Bohannon. How do you feel physically in general? Are you in pain? Are you foggy? Are you on meds? What's going on with your day-to-day routine in terms of how you feel and what your regimen is?
Mostly, I'm probably a little more fatigued than I used to be. Occasionally, I'm short of breath. I did for a while suffer just what I might call, I guess, a generally achy condition, but Tylenol seems to have cured that, and I've been given a pretty good supply of morphine, so I've got that to fall back on. Actually, this cancer has really not pained me at all. I watched two friends of mine die of cancer, and that was ugly, and I remember thinking, thank goodness the men in my family tend to die of cardiovascular disease, but looks like that's not going to be the case. On the other hand, no pain. My only symptom initially was quite a drastic weight loss. I lost about 100 pounds and noticed it about 30 in. But by that time, they had already diagnosed that this had gone too far. I have esophageal cancer, a tumor at the base of my esophagus where it joins the stomach. And it has subsequently spread to my liver and now my lungs. So I asked one doctor what my odds are of seeing 2023, and he said 50-50. So I guess that's where I am.
You have a marvelous attitude, and you and I have had prior conversations. You know that I have told you that although I respect medical science and the inevitable for all of us and, you know, the way the cards fall on the table, I am not one to totally believe it because I've seen in my own life the doctors and the odds and the course of illnesses not always come to the to fruition as they plan or they think or they fear. So I guess that's called hope. And
it is, and it's also called reality, Michael. I mean, the fact is that it's not an exact science. I could have 3 weeks. I could have 3 months. I mean, who knows? I might be around watching the 2024 election, for all I know. But you're quite correct. It's not exact. But I wanted to go out on my terms, and the problem is I must have asked 8 or 9 doctors, you know, how do I know at what point I'll still be lucid I won't have waited too long before pain racks me or I'm dopey with drugs? And they all said, we don't know. It's each individual case. So I arbitrarily selected Friday, the 14th of October, as a date where I was pretty sure I could go out on my own. And it's going to be a goodbye program. It's not going to be just a Jimbo pity party. I mean, people can talk about the issues of the day, or if they want to get in one last shot at me, well, that's fine. There aren't many benefits to terminal illnesses, but one of them is I won't have to talk to you again. So,
well, I mean, you know, terminal illnesses mean you don't have to pay rent anymore and all that kind of stuff. I mean, life is a struggle.
Well, there is that. Of course, I got the wife to consider, and so.
How is Annabelle handling this?
She's handling it pretty well. We were actually diagnosed back in 2021, within 3 weeks of each other. We both had cancer. She had a tumor on her right kidney, which they froze to death. And she's fine now. They just check her every several months to be sure that there's been no recurrence. But she's fine. So she's been a real trooper, and I've tried to be the best patient possible. I've suffered extreme neuropathy in my feet, my fingers, numbness. Very hard for me to type. I used to be a pretty good typist, and now it's just eating away with these tree stumps I call fingers. But I wanted to be able to go out in a way that did my audience credit, and then I'm afraid I'm in hospice, in home hospice now. Gets too much for Annabelle. There's a physical facility I'll be going to, and I've worried a lot about that. I don't want to be a burden on her. So.
Well, you're a very good man, and she's obviously a wonderful wife, and you're a great couple, and you're great people. So you were both diagnosed with cancer back in 21, within days of each other. First of all, 21 was a rough year because it was... It was an extension of 2020, which was considered a terrible year, and it's in the middle of a pandemic. Having any disease other than COVID is a problem. At least it was a problem during the height of the pandemic. But aside, how did the two of you come to any kind of a new philosophical understanding as a couple when you both were faced with the grim reality of that type of a diagnosis?
Well, we did. I think that we both recognize that all time together is precious, and of course, for each of us, it was a second marriage, so we didn't have all that much time together. We just observed our 24th anniversary in August. So, I think we recognize that all time together is precious.
Mm. Second marriages tend to be very different in terms of experience, wisdom, and the basics than first marriages. That's my observation. You have any comments on that?
Yeah. I would say you're correct, really. Although it's not fair for me to say, but I'll say it anyway. I guess my first marriage was kind of a starter marriage or a preseason scrimmage, if you will, and I made a lot of mistakes, which I hope I didn't repeat with Annabelle. So, yeah, I think that it is a different perspective, and especially a later in life second marriage, in which you recognize that there aren't going to be a lot more opportunities after this, and you really want to make it work.
Every day counts, and you know something. I mean, when you have doctors telling you the finiteness of your life, you really know something that most people don't know, because everybody's life is finite, and everybody could be one day away from death. It's just that a lot of people go through life not cognizant of that ever-present reality. Cognizance of that reality gives you a different appreciation for the minutes, the minute-by-minute life. I mean, people that wish their lives away, I just say to myself, oh, my gosh, you've got so much to learn. So, what are your thoughts about that subject?
Well, I'm sure I know many people. A lot of my friends are contemporaries of mine. I'm no spring chicken, so I'm quite sure that I know a lot of people, at least a fair number of whom, will be dead within, say, a year. They don't know for sure, and I don't know for sure, but that is the likelihood. I suppose, in a way, it's been a bit of an advantage. I can understand people saying, oh, I wouldn't want to know, but it does give me enough time to make sure that all the T's are crossed and the I's are dotted in my life, and I've done what I can to look after Annabelle and her life after I'm gone. But I think you're exactly right that in a way it is an advantage. I have a peek at the future, and that's fine. I have no problem with that.
Are you a man of faith? Do you have particularly well-formed or maybe notions about what lies beyond? How do you process that in terms of your own consciousness?
I've always had a Protestant background and upbringing, and that has, I think, tutored me in that direction.
So you have you're open to the idea. As Jimmy Carter said, when Jimmy Carter seemed so close to death several years ago, do you remember that?
I remember that, yes.
And they
and
said
here he still is.
Yeah, well, they said he had days left, and they asked him that question, how do you feel about it? Sort of what I'm asking you. And he said, well, you know, I'm kind of looking at it as a potential adventure. I those words rang in my head. Probably the most important thing I ever heard Jimmy Carter say. That he said he's looking forward to, you know, an adventure. You see, Jim, I spend obviously a lot of my thinking time about media and radio and the radio business and all that and politics, and people tend to think that's what I'm all about. So often we're judged, or people get the impression that, you know, what we do for a living or what we're known for is what we really think about. I'm actually spend most of my time thinking about these things: what lies beyond life, what is consciousness, not only where are we or who are we, but what are we? If you were born, the amazing miracle of having been born, well, what's to say you can't be born again? What's to say about anything in terms of our existence? I spend a lot of my time reading Eastern philosophy, contemporary philosophy, metaphysics, quantum theory. I've always gotten the impression, anytime I must have interviewed you 10, 20 times over the years, I get the feeling that you're more of a here and now kind of a thinker. But do you?
I suppose I am, which basically means shallow, really. I mean, you are a deep individual, and I know that much about Michael Harrison to know that he's not blowing smoke. He does think a lot about and care a lot about these deep questions. I'm not that much that way. I'm more of a here and now, what's next, and then what's next after that kind of individual. That's true.
Mm. Well, it doesn't necessarily mean that you're shallow or I'm deeper. I might be more foolish. You might be absolutely
no,
absolutely
you
right.
Really, you really think about it, and
yeah.
I really haven't. And it has occurred to me maybe I missed out on a good bet. Maybe I should have thought more about it.
Well, you still can think about it, and you may have a long time to think about it when it becomes known to you, because none of us really know what it is all about.
Right.
You said something interesting a few minutes ago. You said that it won't be a pity party. You're going to be on for another week. To timestamp this conversation, and it's at 2:15 p.m. Eastern on October 9th. 2022. We're having this conversation on a Sunday. I would never want to have this conversation during a work day when I'm interrupted and distracted by things. And when you and I decided to do this, it's been on my mind constantly now for, I don't know, it's been 2 days since we decided we'll have a conversation. But just to put this in perspective, tomorrow from our timeline, it's going to be announced.
That's correct.
It hasn't been announced yet as of this moment that you
no,
will be...
as we speak, no. It'll be announced on Monday, the 10th of October.
And the announcement will be that you're going to step down or step out or cease to continue to do the Jim Bohannon show the following Monday. The following Friday will be your last day.
Friday the 14th.
Friday the 14th.
Right. Last of Bohannon show so, that evening, yeah.
So your listeners, by and large, although there might be rumors floating around because you have had a lot of fill-in people and people wonder what's going on, but your listeners at this moment really do not know. What do you plan to tell them on tomorrow night's show?
I plan to tell them just what... let me get something straight. By tomorrow night, do you mean what, Monday night show?
I mean Monday night show after it's been revealed to the trades.
I had planned to pretty much hold my usual shows, and if someone asks a question, I'll give a straightforward answer. But my real goodbye will be reserved for October the 14th, Friday.
Oh. I see it. Do you actually believe that you're going to be able to keep the show from turning to that? I mean, listeners today read the trades. Listeners today hear things. You might find yourself in a situation where a lot of people want to talk to you about it.
Well, that's probably true. I probably underestimate the extent to which fans of talk radio are necessarily in the know. So you may be right. And again, if there's a guest there, we'll stay with what the guest is there to talk about. Otherwise, if people want to get into the discussion in the last hour of the program, why, that's fine. Mm. That's fine.
You mentioned that might be an opportunity for people to tell you what they think of you or, you know, tell you off or disagree. I don't think there are that many people that listen to you that... disagree with you because you're not disagreeable. That's my opinion. I don't know what your response to that would be. Well, go ahead. What is your response to that observation?
I suspect that that my on-air relationship with the audience has been less contentious than many talk show hosts. I don't think that probably, and this may not be correct, but I would suspect, given what I hear on the radio, that I am probably a less in-your-face, contentious kind of individual. So probably you're right. I would be surprised if there were a great many of good riddance, if you will, final comments. But if that's what they want to do, hey, it's talk radio.
Do you get hate mail? One of the things that anybody in the media today complains about, at least they do to me, and especially the ones that are dealing with polarized politics here in 2022, they get a lot of hate mail. You know, so-and-so, and, you know, people just are despicable in their cowardly hate mail because they could be anonymous in social media, et cetera. Do you find that you get any of that? Or some of it?
Very little. I've had a smattering, just a tiny handful, but very few, actually. I know that there was a person who once informed me that he was monitoring my show and was keeping track of what he considered the hateful comments that I was making, and I didn't even bother to respond to the letter, but I remember thinking, I'm not sure exactly what this person is compiling, but whatever. Everybody needs a hobby, so compile away.
And when you're out
there,
I've
never had anybody, for example, complain to the Federal Communications Commission or anything like that.
No, but when you're out there, you never know. You know, in broadcasting, you know, you're casting a wide net. In today's world, it's very easy for people to get back in touch. And one of the things I find is that there is a certain percentage of the public that suffer from either a mild or a severe form of insanity, and they focus on things that are really not that important or really none of their business, and they become obsessed with it. And sometimes they turn that on individuals who are out there in the news or in the media, and it can be very, very troubling to some people who are not used to that, don't expect it, or are thin-skinned or timid. It's a tough time to be out there. It's dangerous to be famous. It's dangerous to be a celebrity. It's dangerous to be outspoken in today's world. Perhaps it always has been, but it is
no, less
more
so.
So today.
I mean, it used to be less so. I mean, it is more of all of that today. It is.
So you'll be on until the 14th. Then a fellow, Rich Valdez.
Rich Valdez is his name, right? He's been a producer for Mark Levin, and has filled in, I think, some for Mark. And now he will be taking over the Jim Bohannon Show Monday through Friday evenings from 10 p.m. to 1 a.m. Eastern time, starting Monday the 17th of October.
Do you think that Cumulus will remain, at least in the near future, committed to having late night live talk radio? We seem to see so much of the cutbacks and nighttime radio. One of the things that makes you so special, aside from all the other things that make you special, is that you're one of the rare late night shows live. And I mean, can't say local, but you're local in the lives of a lot of your listeners, and I want to get into that in a minute. But any insight into their, I don't want you to say things out of school, and I don't want to hurt anybody, but a lot of people are going to say, well, he's taking in a tough job, Valdez, filling Jim Bohannon's shoes, and plus being on late at night. What do you think?
Well, first of all, I can be completely candid with you because I don't know. Mm-hmm. I know that when I notified when I notified Westwood One Cumulus, the company that that owns the show, they deliberated for several days, and then they announced that Rich Valdez, who had in fact been doing a lot of filling in for me, would be the person to take over. And so I assume that at least in the short run that they are committed. I mean, none of us knows what the financial circumstances of radio will be as it commences its second century. But I believe that, yes, as far as I can tell, they are so committed. And obviously, financial situations can change, and that could change tomorrow. But I think they are.
Well, you know, short run, long run, the whole concept of long and short run is going through changes nowadays. And it is interesting.
Yeah.
It's almost shocking. Radio's going into its second century. It's interesting you mentioned Mutual, and it's an understandable slip. It was Mutual when you began, when you filled in for Larry King, and there have been a number of owners, different names, sometimes the same name with different owners. So you have survived for a very long time doing the Jim Bohannon Show night after night after night through all of these different regimes. How long has it been now that you have been doing this show?
Well, I go back to the beginning. I first started working for the company in the spring of 1980 when I joined WCFL in Chicago as host of their morning show. And then while I was there, it was owned at the time by Mutual. While there, I was asked to fill in for Larry King one night. That was in November of 1981. And so I did, and then I fairly soon became the go-to fill-in person. And when my contract with WCFL was up, in 83, they moved me to Washington. And they had me do some anchoring, but mostly I was there to fill in for Larry King, which I did. And the Jim Bohannon Show, the Saturday night version, came along in September of 84. And now I've had the weeknight show since January of 93. So I will miss 30 years of hosting this show by just a few months.
30 years of hosting a show. Now, doing a show, doing a talk show for a long time, becomes about a relationship with an audience. It starts out as a relationship with an ownership. You work for the people that you work for. And and those are the ones that are listening, and you're playing to the program director, you're playing to the manager, the station owner, whatever. And then as time goes by, and it takes time to grow an audience that has a relationship where there's a connection between the host and the audience. I would imagine the story of your connection with an audience or with a series of audiences or an audience that morphs into a new audience, is a tremendously interesting and dramatic subject unto itself. I don't know if you've thought about this. I don't know if I'm throwing a curveball at you or what, but first of all, am I on the right track that when you get on the air at night that you're doing a show for and with an audience that you feel you know and they know you?
Yes, absolutely. And it has evolved over the years, certainly. In the beginning, I was a fill-in for Larry King, and the first night that I had the show to myself, in some people's minds, I'm sure I remained a fill-in, and after all, Larry King only lasted in that time slot 15 years, and nobody would have predicted that I would have lasted almost 30 years. So, yeah, absolutely, it has evolved. In the beginning, Larry just did a general interest talk show. He wasn't at all ideological or tied to the big events of the day. He would do a show if something major was happening. But he also did a lot of just fun hours on the radio. And I've continued that tradition. I just don't believe that average people, normal people, are 100% ideological and filled with this, well, hatred is not too strong a term for some people, filled with this bile that they must pour forth on others who disagree with them. And that's so we've always tried to include a few things that are fun or civic-minded. The presidents and vice presidents of the American Legion, Girls State and Boys State, we interview those every year. It's just little things like that that we try to do. We have occasional moments of fun. We did an hour one night on whether the toilet paper should hang over the front or the back of the roll. And by the way, the answer is the front, 2-1, roughly.
I was going to ask, what is the result? That's the kind of stuff that some people consider old-fashioned talk radio.
I'm sure they do, and I'm not sure anybody would recreate what I do from scratch today. But the audience seems to like it.
Oh, I think all audiences like it. And I think the reason audiences like it is because they like the host. I think the smartest thing that a likable host, meaning a host like you who has a relationship with the audience, as opposed to the discomfort of coming in as an unknown and then having to prove yourself and having to establish who you are. So much of what we say and do in conversation is based upon an understanding that the audience or the person we're talking to, if it's just a private conversation, they know where we're coming from because they know us. You can't do that for a while in talk radio. It takes time to develop the relationship. Once you have the relationship, which, my gosh, you're the poster boy for a relationship with an audience, my goodness, you can mix in with the serious stuff. You can mix in the light chatter and the connection of being a friend. One of the things about late night radio, and you can certainly address this topic, is it really plays into the role of radio as companion, as opposed to a place where you get the red meat for affirmation about what you think politically.
Absolutely. It is companionship. It absolutely. I know that our mutual friend, Harlan Cook, who consults radio stations, has often said that, you know, you should always be talking about our and we. when dealing with the audience. And that's true. I think that it's very important that we keep that in mind, that this is a personal thing. You and me. And I'm not talking to millions of people, although I am, but I'm talking to you individually. You, wherever you may be, listening in your car, sitting in front of a fireplace, whatever. I guess some people sit in front of a fireplace and listen to the radio. It is personal, at least at its best.
Or the fireplace of the mind, you know. We still use the term fireplace chat.
Exactly, the theater of the mind, the fireplace of the mind.
Well, I mean, at our conventions, we actually have the audacity to call the one-on-one interview on stage a fireside chat. You know, I have fireside chats with people every year in June when it's 90 degrees outside and there ain't no fire. But I think that goes back to FDR, which is before my time. I love to be able to say things that are before my time.
Exactly.
But, and I have to tell you something else. There is the fear of saying anything that's even of my time because people listen in snapshots. And you just say one thing about, you know, the Beatles or JFK, the guy's stuck in the past. The people don't remember that. They don't care about that. You're not going to get younger listeners. And there's that whole deal that goes on. But now that whole fireside chat, that whole fireside intimacy really is important. And another thing I found is that the development of earbuds or airbuds, people listening with headphones as opposed to from speakers. And I hear that people that go to sleep even at night listening to the radio or listening to podcasts or whatever to help them fall asleep, they do so not with the speaker going, but with the earbud or the earplug in their ears. This has changed the nature of the one-on-one versus the one-on-many nature of radio. And it really is because people are not listening on big boom boxes or to audiences of more than one for the most part. Even in the car, the kids in the back are watching a cartoon on the screen. It's changed the nature of radio where the big voice, you know, you're listening to the Big Town Sound from the top of the mountain. that whole bigness nature has changed. Have you found that to be the case over the years?
I find it very much so. Yes, absolutely. And I don't think that any of the modern-day so-called substitutes really are substitutes. I mean, social media, Twitter, and what have you, I just don't think it's the same thing. I mean, there's something about the personal that really adds up to a great deal. This may not be entirely comparable, but, I mean, much is made of the letters of John and Abigail Adams, our second president. And I don't think somehow that the tweets of Barack and Michelle Obama will ever replace those. I just really don't. I mean, there was something about the personal nature of a letter written back then. And likewise, I think there is something about the personal nature of radio at night when people do tend to be more by themselves. I think that does matter a lot. And it doesn't make other times of the day inferior, but I think it to an extent makes the other times of the day different. I really do. And maybe I wouldn't have done as well in other times of the day if I had been focused on that direction. But again, my beginnings at the network level were with the Larry King Show, and it was a nighttime show. So I think that probably worked out for the best.
Well, nighttime radio, most people who love radio, the late Alan Colmes, who was one of my best friends in life. We started as kids together in the business back at Hofstra. Alan always used to tell me, I want to be on at night, but they put me on in the day. They'd say, what do you want to be on at night? You know, daytime. But he said, real radio is at night. That some of the great shows and personalities were at night because you can get more intimate. You can get down. You're not fighting the clock. There's so many other aspects of it. Oh, gosh, radio today is so under its potential in terms of 24/7, 365, you know.
You
know what I mean?
I mean, like the old Gene Shepherd radio show, on the WOR in New York. One of the great, compelling listening experiences ever. And he had regular members of his audience who would simply not get out of their car. Maybe they were driving somewhere, and they'd get to their destination. They would wait until a commercial break to get out of the car. They wanted to hear what Gene had to say.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, they call that driveway conversations, where you're stuck in the driveway.
Yeah.
You don't get out of your car. Look, the show will come to an end on Friday the 14th. As you look at that now, the worst part of it, is it leaving the relationship you have every night with this audience that you've developed, this ongoing audience that's the same and different all the time, as is the case with radio? Is it leaving the prestige of being a current big-time radio personality, which, of course, in my mind, you'll always be that, but is it leaving the craft and the process of doing radio? What aspect of it in the privacy of your own mind? I hate to be so personal, but this is a big deal, and a lot of people can gain from your insights and your candor. What is the aspect of it that bugs you the most, walking away?
I suppose it's just missing the nighttime appointment with people who want to talk, and of course the vast majority of an audience just wants to listen. I've never had a word with the vast majority of the audience because they prefer to be passive consumers of the discussions that take place. I'll miss that. I really will. I hope I don't bug my wife Annabelle to death over that, or I hope I don't take social occasions to the extent that I still have a few left and twist them into some kind of pseudo talk show. I hope I learned enough not to do that. I'll just, frankly, when that time of evening rolls around, I'll look at that studio rather wistfully. I'll miss it.
On the other hand, if suddenly you start feeling better and you defeat the odds and your life goes on a healthier level with no pain and without the threat hanging over your head of the clock ticking as it is now, would you turn around and say, oh gosh, I left too soon, I wish I were still doing it? Or would you pursue new things in your life to take advantage of the fact that you have a second chapter?
Oh, probably the latter. For one thing, even let's assume that what you just said all came to pass and the doctors were wrong and I did get better. I'm 78. I'm no spring chicken, so it's not exactly as if this whole new chapter of my life is going to take me for the next 50 years. I don't have that left, and that assumes the best possible outcome. And plus, I haven't, during the course of my life, exactly taken pristine care of myself, so I doubt very seriously if I have a lot of time beyond the 78 years in any event. So, yes, I might pursue some further direction, but for the most part, I think I might just take it easy and not become such a habitual consumer of current events. I think I might just lighten up, if you will.
Yeah, well, that certainly would be a break, because everybody is a student, because you have to be up on everything every minute. Wasn't always that way, and that is full time work. You say you're 78. Again, suppose that fate had intervened and you were just a 78-year-old person dealing with the day-to-day aches, pains, and problems that come with it. How do you feel about the concept of quitting while you're on top, quitting while you're ahead? Did that thought ever occur to you when you became 70 and 71 and 72? Like, can I ever see myself just saying, okay, I'm not going to wait for them to throw me out. I'm going to just walk away. I'm not going to go for that extra world championship ring or that extra heavyweight title. Or, this is something that people of a certain age think about. And because there are so many, old timers in our business, and I assume listening to this conversation somewhere down the line, maybe this conversation will wind up in a museum someplace. Who knows? Did you have those thoughts about walking away someday while working and being on top?
Not really. I mean, it occurred to me, and I'm aware of the attitude, but on the other hand, I don't really know what is on top. I mean, maybe my best chapter was a year from now. I mean, I don't know that. Plus, I don't really trust the economy. It's nice that my Social Security check goes up every year because I'm still contributing to it. And mostly, I've always just simply said that I wish for my last words on this planet to be, "We'll be right back."
Oh, that's very, very clever. One of the problems with the whole field of financial planning is no one knows how long they're going to live. You know,
it's a crapshoot.
Totally. And they never talk about that. You know, we'll make sure your retirement is fruitful and we'll look out for you and, you know, blah, 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 blah. Mm. But nobody knows how long they're going to live. If you know you got 5 years or 2 years left, or, you know, you might go 20 years or 25 years. Well, that's a whole different thing about how many acorns you got to store in that tree and what they'll be worth in coming times.
That's right.
It's, I always mutter under my breath when I see these, you know, financial planning companies with their very serious commercials and a happy old couple looking forward to life, you know, and beyond retirement. I go, yeah, right. Only if they live long enough to be in the nursing home suffering from all of the decrepitude that comes with age. This plane of existence ain't for the faint of heart. That's for sure. I want to just tell you, in my opinion, you are one of the most important radio broadcasters of all time. In my opinion, you are one of the nicest people that I've had the pleasure of knowing as a friend and a colleague of all time. I've been on the air for 54 years. I've been publishing talkers for 32 years, and I've done an awful lot of other stuff than those things in this business. You are a remarkable person. You're very well liked and respected in the business on virtue of the accomplishments you've had and longevity. When you said you don't know what your finest hour was, your finest hour is right now. This conversation is your finest hour. Your finest hour is the longevity, the respect that people have. You sound great. You were blessed with a great set of pipes. You were blessed with a great mind. You are blessed with a great character. You are a even-keeled, honest, and fair individual. And something else that I can say as a chronicler and an observer of the radio business for so many years, you're a good neighbor, a good partner, and a good citizen. You look at your affiliates even-handedly. There's no unimportant affiliate in Jim Bohannon's on your radar. There are thousands of stories out there about how if you were on a vacation or you were coming through an area and one of your affiliates were there, it could be the smallest affiliate, you'd stop by, hang with them, take pictures, cut spots. I can't tell you how many stories I've had of people telling me that you helped them in their career, that you have mentored people, that you have encouraged people. You're one of, if not the best guys this business has ever had. So I'm telling this to you so that you can hear it from somebody who knows. I am not just a friend, you know, blowing smoke up your ass. This is important to me. That it's the most important thing that I do in my business is to give credit where credit is due, because that is such a difficult thing for people to get, especially in this nasty world, is to get credit from a reliable source where credit is due. So, I just poured my guts out to tell you what I think of you.
I am so extremely grateful. It will take me another half century just to live up to all that.
Well, you've already lived up to it.
It certainly encompasses everything I hope I've gotten within a couple of miles of, and for you to say that I've attained it, it means everything. It really does, Michael. I can't thank you enough, sir. I really can't.
And there you have it. An uninterrupted conversation with radio talk show host and our beloved colleague, Jim Bohannon. We pray for our dear friend as we thank him and are deeply grateful for his immeasurable contributions to the American radio industry and our lives. Thank you for downloading this program from Podcast One, Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and the Podcast One app, and for following our Tuesday tweets announcing the names of our weekly guests. To sign up, it's at MH Interview. I can be reached directly via email at michael@talkers.com. If you find this show to be of interest and value, please subscribe to it as well as giving it a positive 5-star review on Apple Podcasts. If you're interested in hearing my weekly 1-hour radio show, The Michael Harrison Rap, check out mhwrap.com. Our producer is Matthew B. Harrison. The Michael Harrison Interview. Thank you for listening.
The Michael Harrison Interview is a production of Good Phone Communications presented in association with Podcast One and Talkers Magazine. Copyright 2022, all rights reserved.